after he had showered, they carried on their research into the odd Rael who had agreed to help them. Clued in by what it had said, they had sent their U-shadows into the Unisphere to search for files on the history of Far Away during the Starflyer War. The first surprise was to find just over 1 million files on the period available. It took 8 hours for them to filter it down to relevant and useful information. Even then, there was no direct evidence Katooks had been there. There were endless documents on Bradley Johansson's team of guardians chasing the Starflyer back to its lair, and how they joined up with an odd security team that Nigel Sheldon assigned to help them. Admiral Keim was one of them, of course. That was a common history text. His audacious hyperglider flight over Mount Herculaneum, and subsequent rescue by Nigel himself, Anna, the Judas, Oscar the Martyr, Paula Mayo and the Navy Interdiction Squad, Cat's Claws. "I didn't know it was Nigel who originally sent the cat to Far Away," Coriolan exclaimed. "What was he thinking of?" She was sober again after a meal and a couple of alcohol binder aerosols. Aspects of the search seemed genuinely to interest her. Be fair, he couldn't see the future. There were some appendixes that claimed the pursuit had been aided by an alien, but the context was strange. The Bose Motile was known to be part of Nigel's secret clique at the time. There were no references to a Rael. One file said the Barsoomian group helped Johansson because he had brought their genetic Holy Grail to Far Away. Again, there was nothing about what that grail actually was. "Let's try another angle," Aaron said. He told his U-Shadow to find all files relating to a Commonwealth citizen called Tiger Pansy, around the time of the Starflyer War. The cabin's portal projected a rather startling image.
"No way," Coriolan said.
Aaron stared at the woman in equal disbelief. She was a complete mess. Terrible hair, bad facial reprofiling, ruining the symmetry of her eyes, nose and lips, with appalling cosmetics making them appear worse. Ridiculous breast enlargements, tight short clothes that no girl over 20 could get away with wearing, let alone this one, who must have been close to rejuvenation time again. "Signed to the Wayside Production Company on Oak Tier," Coriolan read off her exovision, "appeared in a large number of their, productions, left them in the last year of the Starflyer War. No subsequent information, nothing. No residency listing on any planetary cybersphere. No records of rejuvenation treatment. No body loss certificate. She simply dropped out of sight." Aaron shook himself and cancelled the projection. Easy enough at the time. There was a mass migration from the lost 23 worlds, which the Primes had invaded. After that, it got even more chaotic. Coincidence? The Rael are not known for their lies. Maybe Katooks did marry her. She certainly looks the emotional type.
"That's not quite how I'd describe her," Coriolan muttered. "And how did she get to Far Away?
The planet was virtually cut off for decades until the Starline started flying there. She must have been with the Johansson team. I don't think it's relevant."
"No, but it's interesting. Why would Rael go there?"
"You want to ask?" She shook her head.
"No, too intimidated."
"I'll ask for you."
"No.
Let's just drop it." "You're right, though. It is interesting. I was obviously given the correct information. Katooks helps humans."
"He said he used to. Until Tiger Pansy was killed.
By the cat, no less. That'd be enough to shock anyone out of their dependency routine, no matter how delightful and ingrained."
"Yes, well, thank Ozzy, Paula Mayo finally caught her."
"Yeah. And in about another 4,000 years, we can all share the joy of her coming out of suspension.
Oh, I won't be around for that, no matter what."
"Katooks knew Paula Mayo," Aaron said. "I wonder if that's relevant."
"How could it be?"
He waited for a moment to see if his subconscious produced any clues. It didn't.
"No idea."
The Artful Dodger's smart core told them the High Angel was calling. "Please prepare for teleport," the alien starship told them.
"Oh, hell,"
Coriolan said as she clambered to her feet.
"I really don't like this."
The cabin vanished. Once again, they were standing in the large circular chamber, facing Katooks. Part,
She wrinkled her nose in distaste. Aaron bowed to the Rael. Thank you for obliging us.
You are welcome,
the big alien whispered. Were you successful?
I have lived through Inigo's early life. It was not that distinguished.
Aaron looked straight at Katux, avoiding Corilin. His gyemotes revealed the pique that the last remark had triggered in her mind. Nonetheless, it must have provided you with an understanding of his behavior patterns.
Guilt drives him.
Guilt?
He spent his whole life hiding what he was from everyone. His family, those he loved, and his enemies.
Are you talking about the Protectorate?
Yes. He was aware of their constant surveillance. Toward the end, he took a perverse enjoyment in maintaining the illusion that he was an ordinary advancer. But such a lie weighed heavily on him. It was one of the main reasons he volunteered for duty at Centurion Station.
All right. I can buy into that scenario. Given the circumstances of his later life, where do you think he might have gone?
Hanko.
Which wasn't the kind of answer Aaron was bracing himself for. Not even close. The second 47 world.
Yes.
I know that was where Anagaska's population originated from, but they were forced off because it became uninhabitable after the Prime attack. There's nothing there. Not anymore.
Inigo was always fascinated by what he considered his true ancestral home,
Katux said.
Remember, he did not belong in Anagaska's advancer culture. Hanko gave him a psychological ground point, amplified by an ancestor obsession rooted in his psyche due to the loss of his father so soon after his birth. Such a trauma affects any child, higher as much as advancer, especially when the event is regarded with such bitterness by his mother.
A wound she kept open, unintentionally or otherwise.
Correct. Hanko provided the perfect solution to someone as displaced as Inigo. A real place, yet at the same time unattainable. The illusion which could not be broken. He often contributed to charities which supplemented the official government restoration teams. A telling point. He was never a wealthy man on Anagaska.
And you think he's gone back there?
If he abandoned Living Dream due to his own uncertainty on the direction it was taking, I would assign it a very high possibility. He is higher. The radiation and climate will have little physical effect on him.
There are a lot of unknowns in this assumption.
If you had certainties, you would not be here.
I apologize. I was expecting you to say he had fled the Commonwealth or there was some secret cabal devoted to helping him, but Hanko would certainly explain why no one has found him.
Will you go there?
Aaron looked over at Corilin, who looked very puzzled.
Yes, he said.
Ambition and good intentions are always an excellent starting point, Lycan said. Then, before you know it, you come right smack up against reality. You either adapt, become realistic, and respond in kind, or you founder along until you sink under the weight of your own capitulations. Now, I know those of you in this auditorium aren't quitters. Hell, quitters couldn't afford these ticket prices. He grinned at the murmur of dutiful amusement. In life, either you get pressured or you apply pressure. Same for business. Three rows back from the small podium, Araminta glanced at her fellow entrepreneurs. It was like the gathering of a clone army, all eager young business people, smartly dressed and sharply styled, hanging on to every word the richest man on the planet had to say about acquiring that wealth. Each one of them was desperate for a tiny hint about which way the market would go, a quip about financial trends, what new law to watch out for, a state project that was worth trying to bandwagon. If they thought the Sheldonite would give them that, they were in for a big disappointment. Basic research. Lycan was a ruthless man. He was in Colwyn City to give another of his How I Made It lectures for publicity and prestige, not to help fledgling rivals. A high profile helped his business, and in addition he got a buzz out of being adulated. This whole evening exemplified his favorite catchphrase, win-win. Beauvais would hate all this, she knew, and smiled secretively at the knowledge. When one was sitting amid the faithful, such thoughts were near sacrilege. But then Beauvais had a bit of a hang-up about the genuinely rich and powerful. All politicians were worthless incompetents, all billionaires corrupt criminals. It was one of those quirks she was fond of.
It could be quite funny hearing his youngest self, the biological 14-year-old, raging about the Cabinet Secretary for Social Affairs. Mr. Bovey had the true hatred of every self-employed person for bureaucracy and the taxes it demanded to keep functioning, and worse, expanding. In her mind, 14-year-olds did not have adult concerns like that. It was all angst and impossible aspirations at that age. She recalled it well. Araminta sighed warm-heartedly, more loudly than she intended. She saw Lycan's gaze flick in her direction, though his speech never faltered. Her lips pressed together in self-censure. The speech was exactly what she had been expecting. Plenty of motivational talk, a few anecdotes, a load of financial services product placement, and an excess of toothy smiles during the pauses for applause and laughter. Araminta even clapped along with the rest of them. It was all standard stuff, but there were some nuggets among the debris. She was interested in his early years, how to make the jump from a small operation like hers up to a more corporate level. According to Lycan, advancement was all a matter of risk and how much of it one was prepared to take. He mentioned self-confidence a lot, along with determination and hard work. Araminta wondered if he'd ever met Laryl. Now that would be an interesting conversation. Lycan finished and was provided with a standing ovation. Araminta got to her feet with the rest of them and applauded half-heartedly. She wished he had been more specific, maybe given some case study examples. The chairman of the Colwyn Small Business Association thanked their distinguished guest and announced that refreshments were available in the function room outside. By the time Araminta made it out of the auditorium, her fellow small business owners were forming tight little groups to chatter away to one another while they gulped down the free drinks and canapes. From the snippets she overheard on her way to the bar, the majority ran virtual companies. Talk was about expansion curves and cross-promotional market penetration and share options and when to merge. Men glanced at her as she walked past. They were welcoming smiles, even a few pings to her U-shadow, offering compliments and invitations. Her U-shadow did not respond. Pings were so adolescent. "If you want to take me out to dinner, have the courage to ask me to my face." She had chosen a deep turquoise dress that complemented her hair colour. Strictly speaking, the neckline was low and the hem high for a business occasion, but she now had the confidence to buck convention, at least on a small level. Independence and all that exposure to Cressida had given her that. "Pear water," she told the barman. "Interesting choice." She turned to find Lycan standing behind her. For someone so rich, his appearance was puzzling. The skin on his face was slightly puffy with flushed cheeks, as if he were permanently out of breath. His biological age was higher than usual, fixed in his late 30s rather than the mid-20s everyone else favoured. The clothes he wore were always expensive, but never quite gelled, as if he got his dress sense from advertisements. His jacket with a sharkskin shimmer was chic, but not with that purple shirt and green neck twister, and the brown shoes were best worn when gardening. "I have to work later tonight," she said. "Can't afford lack of judgment from alcohol." "Good self-control. I like that." "Thank you," she said levelly. "I got the impression you weren't impressed tonight." People nearby were looking their way discreetly. Lycan's voice was as forceful as it had been on the podium. That at least gave the impression of a strong personality. Araminta sipped her pear water, wondering how to play this. "I was hoping for more detail," she told him. "What kind of detail? Come on. You paid for your ticket. You're entitled." "Okay. Small company. Doing well. Needs to step up a level. Do you reinvest profits and ride a gradual expansion with each project slightly larger than the last? Or do you take a bank loan and jump 10 levels? How small a company? One-woman band? Supported by some bots? Company product? Property development? Good choice for a startup. High profitability relative to scale. There is a ceiling, though, especially with one person. After the first 3 properties, there should be enough profit to take on more staff. With that, you move on from 1 property at a time and start multiple developments. Timing for that has never been better. Property is the hot item here today, thanks to Living Dream." "Everything is relative.
With that demand, a developer has to buy high. Then this developer should buy a whole street that's in decline. It's a profit multiplier. The individual unit prices rise because you've taken the entire street up market and made it desirable. That's a big step. The level of risk you are prepared to undertake is proportional to your growth potential. If you don't take it, you are declaring this far and no further. That will define your life. I don't think you want that. Question. Would you advise the staff expansion be accomplished by becoming multiple?
No.
Why not? Going multiple only seems like a solution to a solo act. Ultimately, it's a lifestyle choice rather than a business one. Ask yourself what you can accomplish by being multiple that you can't by good aggressive management. You came to listen to me tonight, so I know you're already thinking ahead, thinking big. Property is a foundation stone for a corporate empire, a good one. I still have a vast property portfolio, but to achieve real market dominance, you must diversify and interlock your interests. That's what Sheldon did. He used his interstellar transport monopoly as a cash source to fund industrial, commercial, and financial enterprises on 100 worlds. At the time of the Starflyer War, he was effectively Emperor of the Commonwealth. Do you want to be our Emperor?
Yes.
Araminta was slightly shaken by his bluntness. She thought he was somehow calling her bluff.
Why?
Because it's a position where you can do whatever you want. The ultimate freedom. Isn't that what we all strive for?
With power comes responsibility.
That's what politicians tell you when they want your vote. There's a difference between political power and financial power, especially out here in the external worlds. I'd like to demonstrate that to you.
How would you do that?
Come and stay with me at my home for a weekend. See firsthand what I've achieved. Decide if that's what you want for yourself.
What about your wives?
It was common knowledge how staunchly committed he was to replicating his idol's ideology and life, including, or perhaps especially, the harem.
What about them?
Won't they mind my visit?
No. They'll be joining us in bed.
That'll teach me. You can't be more direct to my face than that. She was pleased with the way she kept her reaction in check. No startled expression. No giveaway body language, squaring the shoulders, straightening the back. In effect, she was telling him she could hold her own against him any day.
I accept, she said, as if it were some kind of request to review financial statements. I knew I was right about you, he said.
In what way?
You know yourself. You know what you want.
That's always dangerous.
To whom?
To everyone else. That's what makes you so desirable.
Win-win, then. She mocked.
The Alexis Denken slid comfortably into the big airlock at the base of the Rael dome stalk. Behind it, the stars vanished as the wall materialized again. Paula stood up, pulled wrinkles out of her suit jacket self-consciously, and straightened her spine. The High Angel teleported her into Kutux's private chamber. Rael homes traditionally were split into 3 sections, public, residence, and private. One had to be a very good friend indeed to be invited beyond the public. The circular chamber had a pale blue floor, and in keeping with tradition, the ceiling was invisible somewhere overhead. Around her, silver and grey walls rippled as if water were flowing down them, yet there was no sound, no dampness in the air. Beyond the cavorting surface, images of planetscapes and strange galaxies writhed insubstantially. However, one image remained firm and clear, a human face that Paula knew only too well. She inclined her head to the big alien who occupied the center of the chamber.
Paula, I rejoice that you are here.
It's been a long time, Kutux. How are you?
I am well. If I were a human, I would be fit.
I am glad.
I have risen to the High Angel's 5th echelon.
How many are there?
5.
Paula laughed. She had forgotten Kutux's sly humor.
So you're the captain, then?
I have that honor.
Congratulations.
And you, Paula, do you continue to prosper?
I continue to be very busy. For me, that's about the same thing.
That is to be expected. There are few of your species who remain in their bodies for as long as you have.
It's also why I'm here. I need information. Just like the good old days. How intriguing.
Paula cocked her head to one side as she regarded the big alien. The phrase was slightly out of kilter. Kotick's eye clusters remained steady on her. Long ago, it never would have been so bold as to tease her. But then long ago, it had been something of a wreck, until the faraway mission had come along. Of course, she had been very different then, too.
The starship Alini has just visited the Rael Dome. Can you tell me if these people were on board?
Her U-Shadow retrieved image files for Aaron and Corilin.
They were,
Kartux whispered.
What did they want? I believe their mission was confidential.
She gave her old friend a shrewd glance, not liking the conclusions she was drawing.
It was you who saw them,
wasn't it?
Yes.
The bottom set of tentacle limbs shivered slightly, the Rael equivalent of a blush.
Kartux, did you review Inigo's memories?
I did.
Why?
She asked, genuinely concerned.
I thought that had stopped centuries ago. Tiger.
She could not finish. Her gaze was drawn to the face suspended behind the wall. Tiger Pansy's silly, carefree grin looking hauntingly back at her, obviously captured at a moment when the woman had been blissfully happy.
I know, the Rael whispered. It is not a return to my addiction, I assure you. There would be few Rael, indeed, who could refuse the opportunity of experiencing Inigo's mind. He dreams the void, Paula. The void. That evil enigma bedevils us to a degree which humans will never appreciate.
All right. Paula ran her hand back through her hair, making an effort to ignore the uncomfortable personal side effects the case was kicking up.
Inigo's memory cell was stolen from a clinic on Anagaska. Why did you help, Aaron? I did not know the memories were stolen. He arrived in an ultra-drive starship. It was intimated that he was a representative of ANA governance. In truth, he never confirmed that. I am sorry. I believe I was had. How stupid. Me of all Rael. The deception was quite simple.
Don't beat yourself up over it. Happens to the best of us. So what did he want to know?
He asked me to guess where Inigo might be. Clever man. Which is curious in itself.
There aren't many humans who knew of your little problem. One of them must have joined up with the faction. So what did you tell him?
I guessed Inigo might be on Hanko.
Hanko? But it's just a radioactive ruin. She stopped. Examining the idea. But Earth aside, it is his ethnic birth world. Still, an odd choice.
Are you aware he was born higher?
No, I was not. That has never been on any file.
Are you sure?
Kartux's biggest tentacles waved in agitation.
I am 40 years of his early life, Paula. Through me you are talking to the young Inigo.
If ANA governance and I didn't know, then it's pretty certain very few other people did either. That changes his whole profile. No wonder nobody could ever find him. As a hire, he has much greater personal resources.
Will you go after Aaron and Corilin?
I'm not sure. I hadn't envisaged Aaron being so close to finding Inigo. But even if he is on Hanko, it'll take Aaron a while to actually track him down. I need to consult with ANA governance on this. Thank you for helping, Kartux.
You are welcome, Paula. Always.
She was on the verge of asking to be teleported back to her ship, but she hesitated.
What do the Rael think of the pilgrimage? That it is incredibly foolish. Opening the Dyson Alpha barrier was one thing, but this takes your obduracy to a whole new level. Why does ANA governance allow it?
Paula sighed. I have no idea. Humans always want to test their boundaries. It's an instinctive thing.
It is a stupid thing.
We're not as old as you. We don't have species-wide wisdom, let alone responsibility.
Higher humans do.
The tenet of universal responsibility is the root of their culture. But as individuals, they have a long way to go. And as for ANA... it's like the intellectual equivalent of primordial ooze in there.
Who knows what's going to come wiggling out triumphantly at the end of the day? I'm beginning to doubt ANA governance's ability to keep order.
Are you serious?
I don't know, she admitted. This whole event has me badly troubled. There are too many people playing with catastrophic unknowns. Part of me, the old part that worships order, wants to shut down the entire pilgrimage project. It's obviously a monstrous folly. Yet the liberal side of me agrees that these people have a right to seek happiness, especially when nothing in the Commonwealth appeals to them. It's indicative of our cultural heritage that we cannot provide a home for everyone.
But Paula, their right to seek the solution of perfection in the void will endanger the rest of the galaxy. That right cannot be permitted.
Quite. And yet we don't have conclusive proof that the void will respond the way you claim. Katux was silent, as if startled.
You doubt us, Paula?
Humans need to know things for themselves. It's our nature, Katux.
I understand that.
I am sorry for you. We're being too melancholy. I give you my word, I'm working to try to sort out this mess.
As always, you are honorable. I hope you succeed. I would not like to see our two species fall into conflict.
We won't. The High Angel teleported Paula back into the cabin of the Alexis Denken. As in all modern starships, the cabin could provide her with every physical necessity, like a hotel room with a particularly bad view. She ordered a plane chair and took her guitar out of the storage locker. Music was something she had come to late in life. As her genetically ordained compulsions were erased slowly, she found her cultural horizons expanding. Art was a whole area she could never quite appreciate. She was always looking for rationalist explanation in every work. Literature was a lot more satisfactory. Stories had a point, a resolution. Not that there were many books released into the Unisphere these days. Current writers tended to produce outlines and scripts for sensory dramas, but the classics were enjoyable enough. The only genre she tended to shy away from was crime and thrillers. Poetry she ignored as an absurd irrelevance. Music, though, had something for every mood, every place. She took a great deal of pleasure from it, listening to everything from orchestral arrangements to singer-songwriters, jazz to Gaia Nature tonality, choral to star-sphere dance. The Alexis Denken often would streak between star systems, reverberating to the sounds of Rachmaninoff, or Pink Floyd, or Dealey KTC. Paula sat back and started to pluck a few chords at random, then gradually dropped into Johnny Cash's The Wanderer. She did not try to sing. There were some limits in life one just had to accept. Instead, the smart core projected the man in black into the cabin, and he started to croon along to her melody. The song helped her think. She knew she should be heading straight for Oricum, or even Hanko, but she was feeling a lot more troubled by Katux's last comment than she ought to have been. It seemed as though this whole pilgrimage situation was designed to disrupt her judgment and objectivity. That, or I'm just getting lonely and uncertain in my old age. Paula finished strumming. The man in black gave her a forlorn look, and she waved her hand dismissively. The smart core cancelled the projection. Her U-shadow opened a link to Casimir, someone who did have empathy for her position. "What can I do for you?" he asked. "I'm at the High Angel." Aaron gave Inigo's memory cell to Katux. "Someone knew about our friend's predilection."
"Did Katux review it?"
"Oh, yes. Katux told Aaron that Inigo was probably hiding out on Hanko."
"Interesting. Presumably that's where the Artful Dodger, a.k.a. the Alini, is heading?"
"Yes.
Another ultra-drive ship arrived in-system just before the Artful Dodger departed. The Navy commander at High Angel said it stood off in the Cometary Belt and left in hot pursuit."
"Does every faction have ultra-drive ships?" she asked indignantly. "Justine caught the delivery man using a Hawking M-Sync on a Revelo."
"So she told me. I consider it significant that the factions are openly using such technology. This whole pilgrimage event could well be the trigger for an irreversible culture split within the human race."
"Whose side will you take?"
The Navy was created by ANA to protect humans from stronger, hostile aliens. That is what it will continue to do until I am removed from my position. If ANA chooses to leave the physical universe, I will stay behind and ensure that whatever sections of us remain continue to receive that protection. Is that a side, do you think?
No, but it's certainly a plan.
Are you going after Aaron?
Not immediately.
Can you provide some protection for Hanko and Inigo, if he's there?
I will observe and advise you of developments.
But you know the Navy cannot intervene directly in the internal affairs of Commonwealth citizens. Despite the scale of the problem, that's what this is.
Paula was thrown by the answer. She was expecting Casimir to be a lot more helpful.
1,000 years ago, I stuck to the rules, too. No good comes of it.
You need to bend a little, Casimir. You and other representatives exist, so I don't have to. You handle the gray areas, while I deal in black and white.
There's no such thing. Nonetheless, I operate within a set of rules that I will not break.
I understand. Just do what you can, please.
Of course.
The Artful Dodger dropped out of hyperspace 5,000 kilometers above Hanko's equator. Sensors examined the surrounding environment, bringing up several amber warning symbols and even a couple of red ones. The local star had an abnormally large number of sunspots chasing across its surface, producing a dangerously thick solar wind. Below the starship's metallic purple hull, a global cloud blanket reflected the star's sharp white glow back into space, its uniform glare broken only by the vast auroral streamers that lashed across the stratosphere. Above the atmosphere, monstrous arches of violet fluorescence soared far beyond geosynchronous orbit, engorged Van Allen radiation belts that choked the planet with a hurricane of high-energy particles. The Artful Dodger's hull sparked with a corpuscent discharge as it slid across into a high-inclination orbit.
"Welcome to hell," Aaron muttered as he monitored the images from outside.
The ship began to probe through the clouds with high-resolution HICE radar sweeps, standard radar, magnoscan, quantum signature receptors, and electromagnetic sensors, revealing the lay of the frozen land underneath. Several comm-beacon signals appeared on the emerging cartography, the only indication of activity on this bygone world. They broadcast the official channels of the restoration team, asking all arriving ships to make contact.
Corilin watched the images in the portal with a mournful face as the starship flew around and around the planet, building up a detailed survey of the surface. 1,200 years after the prime attack, glaciers still were advancing out of the polar regions.
"I can't believe Inigo was ever attracted to this place," she said.
"You heard, Katux. He enjoyed the idea of an ancestral homeworld.
Even if he came here, he'd take one look and leave. There's nothing here."
"There are restoration teams down there even today," Aaron said, waving at the little scarlet lights dotted across the map. The beacons acted as crude relays across continents, the only communication net on the planet.
"That's got to be the biggest lost cause in the galaxy," she said.
"You're probably right. 17 of the second 47 worlds have officially closed their restoration projects, and the remainder are winding down. Budgets get reduced every year. Nobody kicks up a fuss about it anymore, not like the first couple of centuries after the war." After 10 orbits, the smart core had mapped all the exposed land lurking below the eternal cloud. Sensors had located 23 centers of dense electromagnetic activity. The largest was a force field dome in the center of Kajani, the old capital city. All the others were little more than clumps of machinery and buildings scattered across the dead tundra of 3 continents. No thermal sensor could begin to penetrate the cloud, so he had no way of telling if any of the outposts were occupied. There didn't seem to be any capsules in flight. Electrical activity in the air was strong, interfering with several sensor fields.
"No way of telling if he's down there," Aaron said.
"Not from up here. I can't even see what ships are parked under the force field."
"What were you expecting?"
"Nothing more than this. I'm just scouting the territory before we go in to make sure there are no surprises."
Corilin rubbed her arms, as if the cold from the planet was seeping into the cabin.
"So what's our cover story this time?"
No point in one. It's not like the teams are heavily armed. So you just shoot them one at a time until they give him up to us. He gave her an annoyed stare. We'll tell them that you're searching for a former lover. He changed his name and profile to forget you, but you've tracked him down here. All very romantic. That makes me look like a complete loser. Oh dear. He sneered and told the smart core to call the beacon at Kajani. It took several minutes to get a reply from the shielded base. Eventually, a very startled restoration project director called Ansan Pudala came online to give them landing authority. The Artful Dodger sank deftly through the 3 kilometers of the upper cloud layer. Winds of 200 kilometers per hour buffeted the hull with nearly solid clumps of gray mist, while lightning clawed furiously at the force field. Eventually, they cleared the base of the layer into a stratum of superclear air, and the outside temperature plummeted. A gloomy panorama opened beneath them. Black, ice-locked land was smeared with long dunes of snow. Denuded of vegetation, every geographical feature was shaded in stark monochrome. Long braids of grubby cloud chased across the dead features. "It must have been terrifying," Corilin said sadly. "The Primes dropped 2 flare bombs into the star," Aeron told her. "The only way the Navy could knock them out was by using quantum busters on the Corona. Between them, they produced enough radiation to slaughter every living cell 1,000,000 times over. Hanko's atmosphere absorbed the energy until it reached saturation point, which triggered a superstorm, which in turn threw up enough cloud to cover the planet and kick off an ice age. And the star still hasn't stabilized. Even if it did, it wouldn't matter. The radiation has completely destroyed the biosphere. According to the files, there's some marine life that's still alive in the deepest parts of the oceans, but that's all. The land is as sterile as a surgical chamber. Check out those radiation levels, and we're still 5 kilometers high. I didn't appreciate what a scale this war was fought on. They were going to genocide us. The words were almost painful to speak. It had been a fearful time. Aeron shuddered. How do I know what the war was like? A deeper instinct assured him he was not that old. The Artful Dodger continued its descent through the rampaging lower clouds, blazing with solar brilliance as it sloughed off whip-like tendrils of electrical energy. At this altitude, the wind speeds had dropped to 150 kilometers per hour, but the air density meant the ship's ingrav units were straining to hold them stable against the pressure. Corilin tried not to look alarmed as the starship began to shake. High-velocity ice crystals shattered against the force field as an amok cloud braid hurtled around them. The crunch of disintegrating ice could be heard inside the cabin. "Okay, then, this is why there aren't any capsules flying down here," Aeron muttered. His exovision was showing him the force field dome below, altering its permeability index to allow them through. The wind speed was now less than 100 kilometers. Outside the dome, there was very little evidence of the city remaining. In its time, Kajani had been home to 3 million people. Its force field had warded off the storms in the days following the Prime attack, protecting the wormhole station so that the planet's population could be evacuated to Anagaska. The process had taken over 1 month, with government vehicles transporting refugees from outlying counties on every continent as the storms grew worse and vegetation withered and died. 7 weeks and 3 days after the planet's premier speaker led the way, CST closed the Hanko wormhole. If there were people left on the planet, they were beyond contact. Every effort had been made, every known habitation and isolated farmstead searched. With the people gone, the force fields protecting cities and towns failed one by one, allowing the winds to pound against the buildings and floodwater to scour the ground around them. Not even modern super-strong materials could resist such pummeling forever. The structures began to crumple and collapse. Eventually, with the climate spiraling down into its ice age, the rains chilled to become snow and then ice. Mushy scree piled up against the frozen ruins, obliterating yet more evidence that this once had been an inhabited world. The Artful Dodger passed through the force field and into the calm bubble of warm air that was the restoration team's main base. It was centered on one of Kajani's old parks.
Under the protective auspice of the force field, the ground had been decontaminated and replanted. Grass grew once again, as did a short avenue of trees. Clusters of airborne polyphotospheres shone an imitation sunlight onto the lush greenery. Irrigation pipes provided clean water. There were even native birds and insects humming about, oblivious to the dark sky with its sub-zero winds outside. They landed on a small patch of concrete on the edge of the park that held just one other starship, a 30-year-old commercial combi freighter with a continuous wormhole drive that could carry a mix of cargo and passengers. The difference between the two ships was patent, with the Artful Dodger's smooth chrome-purple hull seeming almost organic compared with the restoration team's workhorse, with its carbon-bonded titanium fuselage and fading paintwork. Aeron and Corilin floated gently down out of the airlock to touch down among the five bulbous landing legs. 10 people had turned out to greet them, quite a crowd by the base's standards. All were curious to see the unscheduled arrivals. Ansan Purala stood at the head of the delegation, a slightly rotund man with fair hair cut short, dressed in a simple dark blue tunic with a restoration logo on the arm.
"Greetings to both of you," he said. "I'd like to know why you're here. We're pleased to see you, of course, don't get me wrong. But we never have visitors. Ever." His attitude was pleasant, but there was an underlying determination.
Aeron's Bionics performed a fast low-level field scan. Director Purala was an ordinary advancer human, as were his co-workers. None were higher.
"It's rather awkward," he said with a twisted smile. "Corey, I'm looking for someone," she said.
It was a low voice, hauntingly mournful. Aeron was impressed. She'd backed it up with a soft ache in the base's tiny Gaia field. The team was suddenly all attention and sympathy.
"A man. Yigo. We were in love. Then it went bad. My fault. I was so stupid. I shouldn't have... I don't want to say."
Aeron put his arm comfortingly around her shoulder as she sniffed convincingly, head bowed.
"There, there," he assured her. "They don't want details."
Corilin nodded bravely and continued.
"He left. It took me a long time before I realized what a mistake I'd made. But I'd hurt him really badly. I've been looking for him for 3 years. He changed his name and his profile, but his sister let slip that he'd come here."
"Who is it?" Director Purilar asked.
"I don't know. All I know was what his sister said, that he joined the restoration project. I just had to come. If there's any chance."
Yes, sure." Purilar glanced at his colleagues, who were busy checking one another out to see if any of them was going to own up to being the one. He waved an arm about. "Anyone look familiar?"
Corilin shook her head despondently. "No. I probably won't recognize him."
She faced her little audience.
"Yigo, please, if it's you, please just tell me. I just want to talk, that's all, please."
Now nobody was meeting her gaze.
"You don't have to do it in front of your friends," she said. "Come to me later. I really, really miss you."
That was accompanied by a burst of sincere desperation into the Gaia field. "All
right, then,"
a thoroughly embarrassed Purala said to his team. "I'll get this organized. We can meet up again at dinner." People broke away, heading back toward the main expanse of grass, keeping their smiles under tight control. As soon as they were a few paces away, couples went into deeply intense conversations, heads close together. Aeron watched them go, keeping his face impassive. The base would be talking about this for the next 20 years. Ansan Purala was left standing in front of his two uninvited guests, one hand scratching at his fuzzy hair in some perplexity. His Gaiamotes were leaking an equal amount of disquiet. "You're welcome to use the accommodation here. There are plenty of spare rooms, a legacy of when the project was conducted on a grander scale. But, quite frankly, I suspect your own ship would be more comfortable." He eyed the Artful Dodger jealously. "Our living quarters haven't been updated in a century."
"That's very kind of you, and of course we'll use the ship," Aeron said. "We have no intention of imposing."
Quite the contrary, Purulal said sheepishly. You are going to be excellent for morale. The only entertainment we get here is sensory dramas, and they tend to pall after a while. Whereas a quest like this, one of us dull old souls with a romantic past, well...
How long have you been here? Aaron asked.
Myself? I will have notched 25 years in the last 130.
Aaron whistled. That's devotion. Do you mind telling me why?
Purulal beckoned to them and set off across the grass. I'm nearly 300 years old, so in fact it's a small portion of my life. I don't mind donating the time, because I can extend my life as long as I want to make up for it.
That sounds almost like higher philosophy.
I suppose it does. I'll probably migrate inward once the restoration project ends. Higher culture appeals to me.
But why that first donation?
Simple enough. I met one of the restored. She died just after the prime attack, caught outside a force field when the storm struck. 700 years later, one of our teams found her corpse and extracted her memory cell. She was relifed in a clone and lived happily on Anagaska. It was her contentment which affected me. She had such a busy, fulfilling life. There was a huge family, her involvement with the local community. I was struck by how much poorer the world, my world, would have been without her. So I signed up for a tour. Then, when you're here, you get to see firsthand the people you find. Follow them from excavation through assessment and DNA extraction, memory cell rehabilitation, right up to real life. You understand? I meet the living individual after I dig up the corpse. Innocent people who were struck down. People who didn't deserve to die. Victims of a hideous war. Maybe it's self-serving. But do you have any idea how good that makes me feel?
I can't even imagine. I can see I'm going to have to make a financial contribution when I get back to Anagaska.
They crossed the big grass field to the low buildings on the other side. Housing for the team members consisted of small individual cottages arranged in 5 neat circles, each with a central clump of community buildings. As they approached, Aaron saw an open-air swimming pool and several barbecue areas. A sports field had been marked out. Only 2 of the circles were in use. It was impossible to see what the cottages were made of. They were all covered by thick creepers with long brown leaves that dangled golden flowers from their tips. It was a pleasant arboreal contrast to the icy desolation outside the force field. A deliberate one, he suspected. The vines were nicely shaggy but pruned, so as not to obstruct windows. Behind the cottages were 2 modern functional blocks. One contained the project laboratories, Purulal explained, while the other housed their maintenance shops and garaged their equipment. We're heavily cybernated, he told them, but even we need a few technicians to repair the bots now and again.
Could he be working as a technician? Aaron asked Corilyn.
Who knows? She said lightly. I just know he's here.
Probably. It is a long shot, after all.
Aaron did not look at her. That hell-damned mouth of hers. He had managed to get into the starship's culinary unit program, altering her patches on his original blocks, so the drinks she ordered had only half the alcohol content she had designated. Her attitude hadn't made any miraculous changes.
Can we meet everyone? Aaron asked.
Sure, I suppose. This is a civil outpost, after all. I'm not exactly a police commissioner, you know. I can't compel anyone who doesn't want to be introduced. He gave Corilyn an apologetic shrug. Anyone who refuses is pretty likely to be him, don't you think? Aaron said.
Sounds about right, the director said.
You do realize that everyone on the planet will now know you're here and why. This is a small operation.
How many people is that exactly?
427 of us, of which 180 are here in the base. 500 years ago there were 6,000 people involved.
How many people have you restored?
2.1 million in total, Purulal said proudly.
Aaron whistled appreciatively.
I had no idea.
The bulk of them were in the early years, of course, but our techniques have improved dramatically since then, thankfully, because even with the cold helping preservation, entropy is our real enemy. Come on, I'll show you. He stepped through the door of the laboratory block.
The assessment room was the first section they looked in, a big clean chamber with 10 long medical tables, surrounded by ply plastic limbs, tipped with instruments and sensors. One of the tables had a recently discovered corpse on it. Aaron wrinkled his nose at the sight. It was hard to tell the thing had been human, a dark lump, wrapped in shrunken cloth and smeared with grime. Its limbs were difficult to determine, showing as long ridges. Strings of hair at one end at least showed him where the head was. After a minute he realized the corpse was curled up in the fetal position. Two of the recovery team were standing beside the table in sealed white overalls, peering down through their bubble helmets as they directed the wand-shaped sensors along various creases in the body's surface. Their movements dislodged grains of snow, which were vacuumed carefully from the tabletop. "We keep the temperature in there the same as outside," Purila said. "Any sudden change in environment could be catastrophic. As it is, we have to keep the assessment room sterile, too."
"Why?"
Cordilin asked. "The radiation has killed off Hanko's microbial life. It's another factor which helps the preservation process. If any bugs got in there, they'd have a feast, and we'd be left with slush." "They must be very delicate by now," Aaron said. "Yes, this one is almost intact. We normally deal with broken segments. Don't you use a stabilizer field?" "Not if we can help it. We found the field actually has a detrimental effect on their memory cells. Don't forget, back then the Commonwealth was still using crystal matrices. In some early cases, we scrambled 10% of the information." "Must be hard to remove the memory cell, then."
"We don't even try. Once we've extracted enough DNA samples to sequence a full genome, we deploy infiltrator filaments into the crystal. Even that can be hazardous. Powering up a memory cell after this long is fatal. It has to be red cold, which is done a molecular layer at a time. Each one takes about 9 months."
"I'd have thought that crystal memory cells would last longer than this."
"They built them pretty robust even back then. But consider what they've endured for 1,200 years. It doesn't help."
"Who is he?"
Cordilin asked.
"She, actually, we think. Ava Sondlin. We'll know for certain when her genome has been read, but the location was right."
"Location?"
"She was found 4 kilometers from her car. In itself, that was hard to find. Washed downstream in a flash flood. We know from records that she lived in the house above the valley's flood level. We think she was making a dash for the nearest town during a break in the storm. There was an official evacuation point set up there, and she informed the authorities she was coming. Never arrived. Must have gotten caught by the winds or the water. Maybe she'll be able to tell us."
"You knew she was missing?"
"Yes. The records of the time aren't perfect, naturally, given the circumstances. But we have a full census, and of course everyone who arrived on Anagaska was fully documented. It's our job to try to determine what happened to those who got lost. We have to handle each case separately. In Ava's case, we've been searching possible locations for 70 years.
"You're bullshitting me," Aaron said.
"I assure you I'm not."
"Sorry, but 70 years?
We start with the route she must have taken, pick the obvious danger points, and seed them with sensor bots. They spread out in a circle, trying to find some trace. Like all our equipment, the bots have improved considerably during the centuries we've been here. The majority are tunnelers, burrowing through the snow and surface soil layers. So much topsoil was displaced during the storms that the continent's whole topology shifted, and now it's all locked into place by the permafrost. 99% of the people we recover these days are buried. It means the bots operate in highly detrimental conditions, even for this world. In total, the restoration project has deployed 450 million since it began. There are still 11 million active and searching. They're not fast-moving, but they are thorough.
How many people are you still looking for?"
"A third of a million. I don't hold out much hope. Most of them will have been washed into the sea." He gestured at the wrinkled lump on the table. "Dear Ava's car was 47 kilometers from the road she used, and that was the easy find. She was deep under sediment. Persistence pays off. We still find about 20 or so each year, even now."
They moved on into DNA sequencing.
To Aaron, it was just an ordinary office with 5 large smart cores. Even in ordinary circumstances, human DNA decomposed quickly. After 1,200 years on Hanko, only the smallest fragments remained. But there were a lot of cells in a body, each with its own fragments. Piecing them together was possible with the right techniques and a vast amount of computing power. Once the main sequences had been established, the project could use family records to fill the gaps. In a lot of cases, there were full DNA records from clinics available. As soon as the body had been identified properly, a clone was grown for re-life. "But not here," Purila said. "Clinics back on Anagaska handle that part. After all, who would want to wake up here? People have enough trouble adjusting to the present, their future, as it is. Most need specialist counseling. Is life that different?" "Essentially, no. And most died hoping for rescue in the form of re-life. It is the amount of time involved which shocks them. None of their immediate family and friends remain. They are very much alone when they wake." After DNA, there was the memory rehabilitation section, where they tried to reassemble the information read from memory cells. It was a process orders of magnitude more complex than DNA sequencing. The history archives were for recovered people who could not be identified. It held all of Hanko's civic records and memoirs of families with lost relatives, the logs and recollections of the evacuation teams, lists of people who may have been visiting Hanko when the attack started, and the inter-solar missing persons list of the time. There were laboratories specializing in analysis of molecular structures, identifying Baroque minute clues the bots had discovered as they wormed their way through Hanko's frozen earth, trying to place flakes of paint with individual car models, tying scraps of cloth to specific clothes, and from there to manufacturer, to retail outlet, to customer lists, to bank statements. There were items of jewelry and even pets. It was a long register of unknown artifacts, each one potentially leading to another lost corpse. The case room had files on everyone still known to be missing. The operations center monitored the sensor bots and the outpost teams that were excavating in terrible conditions. After 2 hours, they had met everyone in the building. None reacted to Corilin, and nobody tried to avoid her. Aaron quietly scanned all of them. No one was enriched with bionics. "There are a few other people around," Purila said. "You'll probably meet them tonight at the canteen. We tend to eat together." "And if he's not there?" Aaron asked. "Then I'm sorry, but there's not much I can do," the director said. He gave Corilin an uncomfortable glance. "Can we visit the outposts?" she asked. "If he is here, he'll know about you by now. He would have used the beacon net to call in. I guess he doesn't want to get back with you." "Seeing me in the flesh might be the one thing he can't resist," Corilin said. "Please." Her outpouring of grief into the Gaia field was disturbing. The director looked deeply unhappy. "If you want to venture outside, there's nothing I can do to stop you. Technically, this is still a free Commonwealth world. You can go wherever you want. I'd have to advise against it, though."
"Why?"
Aaron asked. "You've got a good ship. But even that would be hard-pressed to maneuver close to the ground. We can't use capsules here. The winds are too strong, and the atmospheric energy content too high. The 2 times we tried to use our ship for an emergency rescue nearly ended in disaster. We aborted both and wound up having to re-life the team members."
"My ship has an excellent force field."
"I'm sure it does. But expanding the force field doesn't help. You just give the wind a bigger surface area to push at. Down here it actually makes you more susceptible to the storm. The only stability you have in the air is what your drive units can provide." Aaron did not like it. The Artful Dodger was just about the best protection possible under normal circumstances. He could not forget the way the regrav units had approached their limits while bringing them down to the base's force field dome, and that had been a big target. "How do your teams get about?" he asked.
"Ground crawlers. They weigh 3 tons apiece and move on tracks. They're not fast, but they are dependable."
"Can we borrow one? There must be some you're not using. You said there used to be a lot more personnel here at one time.
Just an old one will do. Look, really, he's not here.
Whatever release document you want us to certify will do it, Coriolan said. Please, give me this last chance.
I've got over 20 teams out there. Half of them aren't even on this continent. We use the polar caps as a bridge to get to the other land masses. It would take you a year to get around them all.
At least we can make a start.
If Yigo hears we're going around to everyone, he'll know he'll have to face me eventually. That might make him get in contact.
Purala rubbed agitated fingers across his forehead.
It will have to be the mother of all legal release claims. I can't have any comeback against the project.
I understand. And thank you.
After dinner, Aaron and Coriolan made their way to the second block to inspect the ground crawler Purala was reluctantly allowing them to use. Overhead, the airborne lights were dimming to a gentle twilight. The effect was spoiled by constant flares of lightning outside the force field.
He wasn't at the canteen then?
Coriolan asked. No, I've scanned everyone in the base now. None of them have bionics, though quite a few have some interesting enrichments. It can't be as tame here as the good director claims.
You always judge people, don't you?
Quite the opposite. I don't care what they do to each other in the privacy of their own cottage. I just need to make a threat assessment. The malmetal door of Garage 11 rolled apart to show them the ground crawler. It was a simple wedge shape of metal on four low caterpillar tracks. With the bodywork painted bright orange, its slit windows made empty black gashes in the sides. Force field projectors were lumpy bulbs on the upper edges, along with crab-like maintenance bots that clung to the surface like marsupial babies. When Aaron queried the vehicle's net, he found it had a large self-repair function. A third of the cargo compartments were filled with spares.
We should be all right in this, he told her. The net will drive it. All we have to do is tell it where we want to go.
And that is, exactly? You know, Purala was right. If Inigo is here, then he knows I'm here looking for him. He would have contacted us. Me, at least.
Would he?
Oh, don't, she said, her face furrowed in disgust. Just don't.
He obviously doesn't miss you as much as you miss him. He left, remember?
Screw you, she screamed. Don't hide from this. Not now. I need you functional.
Functional,
she sneered. Well, I'm not. And if we find him, the first thing I'll tell him is not to help you, you psycho fuck misfit.
I never expected anything else from you.
She glowered but didn't walk away. Aaron smiled behind her back.
If he's here, the pilgrimage will be long gone before we find him, she said sulkily.
Not quite. Remember, we have an advantage that lets us reduce the search field. We know he's higher.
How does that help?
There was disdain in her voice still, but it was warring with curiosity now. The field scan effect would be very useful out there, helping to track down bodies buried in the ground. I can use it to detect anomalies several hundred meters away. It's a little more difficult through a solid mass, but the pervasive function is still capable of reaching a reasonable distance.
If he's here, he'll have a better success rate than the others, she said.
There are other factors, such as getting the location of a lost person reasonably accurate, which all depends on how well an individual case has been researched. But yes, it's a reasonable assumption to say the team with the best success rate will be Inigo's.
Is there one?
Yep. My U-Shadow didn't even have to hack any files. They're all open to review. The team with the current highest recovery rate is working up at Olhava province. That's on this continent, 900 kilometers southwest. If we start first thing tomorrow morning, we'll be there in 48 hours.
Oscar Munro had fallen in love with the house the first moment he saw it. It was a plain circle with a high glass wall separating floor and ceiling that stood 5 meters off the ground on a central pillar that contained a spiral staircase. Both the base and the roof were made of a smooth artificial rock, similar to white granite, and it shone like mountaintop snow in Oricum's blue-tinged sunlight. The sprawling grounds outside resembled grand historical parkland that had fallen into disuse, with woolly grass, overgrowing paths, lines of ornamental trees, and a couple of lakes with a little waterfall between them.
There were even some brick Hellenic structures resting in deep nooks, swamped by moss and flowering creepers to add to the image of great age. That image was one that several dozen gardening pots worked hard at achieving. He had lived there for 19 years now. It was a wonderful home to return to every time his pilot shift was over, devoid of stress and the kind of bullshit politics that went in tandem with any corporate job. Oscar flew commercial starships for Oricum's thriving national space line, which had routes to over 20 external planets. Piloting was the only job he had sought since he had been relifed. Waking up in the clinic had been one hell of a surprise. The last thing he remembered was crashing his hyperglider into an identical one piloted by Anna Keim, saving the Commonwealth. Good. Killing the wife of his best friend, not so hot. Without Anna to wreck their flight, Wilson Keim should have managed to fly unimpeded on a mission that was pivotal in the Starflyer War. Oscar could remember the instant before the collision, a moment of complete serenity. He had not expected anyone to recover his memory cell, not after his confession that in his youth he had been involved in an act of politically motivated terrorism that had killed 408 people, a third of them without memory cells, mostly children too young for the inserts. The fact that he'd never intended it, that the deaths had been a mistake, that they had missed their actual target, that should not have counted in his favor. But it seemed as though his service to the Commonwealth and his ultimate sacrifice had meant something to the judge. He wanted to think Wilson maybe had paid for a decent lawyer. They had been good friends. "I guess that means we won then," were his first words. It even sounded like his own voice. Above him, a youthful doctor's face smiled. "Welcome back, Mr. Yao Hui," he said. "Call me Oscar." I was that longer than I was ever Yao Hui. That was his new identity when he went on the run for over 40 years. "As you wish." Oscar managed to prop himself up on his elbows, a movement that surprised him. He had seen real-life clones several times, pitiful things with thin flesh stretched over bones and organs that had been force-grown to adolescence, unable to move for months while they painfully built up muscle mass. This body, though, seemed almost complete, which meant the technique had improved. There had been a lot of body loss in the war, tens of millions at least. He probably had been shoved down to the bottom of the list. "How long?" "Please understand, Oscar. You were put on trial for your, previous crime. It set quite a few legal precedents, given your, state at the time." "What trial?" "What do you mean, state?" "I was dead." "You suffered body loss. Your memory cell survived the crash intact. Legally, that is recognized by the Commonwealth as being your true self. It was recovered by one Paula Mayo." "Ah." Oscar suddenly was getting a very bad feeling about this. "Paula recovered me?" "Yes. You and Anna Keim. She brought both of you back to Earth."
"But Anna was a Starflyer agent."
"Yes. Under the terms of the Doi Amnesty, her Starflyer conditioning was edited out of her memories, and she was relifed as a normal human. Apparently, she went on to have a long life and a successful marriage to Wilson Keim. She was certainly on the Discovery with him when it flew around the galaxy."
Oscar's shoulders were not so strong after all. He sagged back onto the mattress. "How long?" he repeated. There was an urgency in his growl.
"You were found guilty at the trial. Your Navy service record was a mitigating factor in sentencing, of course, but it couldn't compensate for the number of people who were killed at Abaddon Station. The judge gave you suspension. But as the Commonwealth clinics were unable to cope with the sheer quantity of non-criminals requiring re-life at the time, he allowed you to remain as a stored memory rather than be re-lifed before the sentence began."
"How long?" Oscar whispered.
"You were sentenced to 1,100 years.
"Fuck me!"
He was all alone. That was probably a worse punishment than suspension. After all, he was not aware of time passing during that millennium. He could not reflect and repent his wrongdoing. But in this present, life was different. Everyone he had known had either died or migrated inward. Ridiculous phrase.
a politically correct way of saying they had committed euthanasia with a safety net. Maybe that was the point of suspension after all. It certainly hurt. So with no friends, no family, knowledge and skills that even museums would not be interested in, Oscar Munro had to start afresh. The Navy, understandably, did not want him. He explained that he didn't expect to be part of the deterrence fleet and offered to retrain as a pilot for their exploration crews. They declined again. Back before the Starflyer War, he had worked in the exploration division at CST, opening new planets, giving people a fresh start. Was like a self-imposed penance, except that he'd really enjoyed it. So he did train as a starship pilot. Fortunately, the modern continuous wormhole drive used principles and theories developed during his first life. He brought himself up to speed on its current technology applications quite rapidly. Oricum Solar Star was the third company he had worked for since his re-life. It wasn't much different from any other external world starline. In fact, it was smaller than most. Oricum was on the edge of the Greater Commonwealth, settled for a mere 200 years. But that location made it a chief candidate from which to mount new exploration flights, opening up yet more worlds. They were rare events. The Navy had charted every star system directly outside the external worlds. Expansion to new worlds was also at a historical low. The boundary between central and external worlds had not changed much for centuries. The old assumption that higher culture always would be extending outward and that ordinary humans would be an expanding wave in front of it was proving to be a fallacy. With inward migration, the number of higher humans remained about constant, and the external worlds provided just about every kind of society in terms of ethnicity, ideology, technology, and religion. Should any citizen feel disenfranchised on their own planet, they just had to take a commercial flight to relocate. There was very little reason to found a new world these days. In the 19 years he had been on Oricum, Solar Star had launched only 3 planetary survey flights. 2 of them had been closer than the distance the company's long-range commercial flights traveled, hardly breaking through to new frontiers. But he had seniority now. If another outward venture came along, he ought to be chosen. Like all pilots, he was an eternal optimist. There was no hint of that elusive mission in the company offices when he filed his flight report. He'd just gotten back from a long-haul flight to Troyan, 70 light-years away, a 15-hour trip with nothing to do other than talk to the Smart Corps and trawl the Unisphere for anything interesting. One day soon, he was sure, people finally would chuck the notion that they had to have a fellow human in charge. He was sitting in front of the starship only for public relations. In fact, there were probably people sitting in the passenger cabin who were better qualified than he if repairs were needed. Not that they ever were. But at least he got to visit new planets. The same ones, over and over again. His regrav capsule sank out of the wispy clouds to curve sedately around the house and land on the grass beside the spinney of lofty rankata trees, nearly 20 meters tall, with reddish-brown whip leaves that swayed in the mild breeze. He climbed out and took a deep breath of the warm, plains-scented air. Out beyond the horizon, Oricum's untamed countryside was carpeted by spiky wildflowers that budded most of the year. Another reason to choose Oricum was its benign climate. Jesseral was walking out from underneath the house. The splendidly handsome youth did not quite have a welcoming smile on his face, but definitely looked relieved to see Oscar. He was wearing only a pair of knee-length white trousers, showing off a tanned body that always got Oscar's blood pumping a little faster. Jesseral was the youngest of his 3 life partners, barely 20. That, Oscar suspected, probably qualified him as the worst punk skunk in the galaxy. 1,000-year-plus age gap. It was delightfully naughty. The youth opened his arms wide and gave Oscar a big hug to accompany a long, sultry kiss. Enthusiasm sprayed out heedlessly into the Gaia field. "What's the matter?" Oscar asked. "Them," Jezeral said, stabbing a thumb dismissively back at the house. Oscar refused to sigh. He and his other partners, Dushiku and Anja, had been a stable trio for over a decade. They were both over 100 and completely at ease with each other. At their age, they understood perfectly the little accommodations necessary to make any relationship work. It was taking everyone longer than expected to accommodate and adjust to the newcomer, who did not have anything like their experience and sophistication. That was what made him so exciting, in and out of bed. What have they done?
It's a surprise for you, and I know how you hate surprises.
Not always, Oscar assured him. Depends if it's good or bad. What's this one?
Oh, no, I'm just telling you there is a surprise for you. I don't want you to be upset that it's there, that's all.
Oscar used a macrocellular cluster to connect to the house's net. Whatever was waiting inside had been blocked skillfully. That would be Anja, who developed commercial neural routines. She was one of the best on the planet.
You have the strangest logic I've ever known, Oscar said.
Jesseral smiled broadly.
Come on, I can't wait.
He tugged at Oscar's arm, his outpouring of enthusiasm shining like sunrise.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.